Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
Good evening and welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. On tonight's show, we'll be talking about why eating disorders are on the rise among Bay Area teens.
And then we'll air my interview with Dan Zielinski about what might be San Francisco's strangest museum, the Musée Mécanique. But first, let's check in on the state of COVID and learn more about vaccines for kids and booster shots, which one to get and why.
Well, welcome back to State of the Bay. We've got our COVID team here. It's Peter Chin Hong and Aaron Alday. You're our family now. Thanks for being here, both of you.
Thanks for having us, Brett. Great to hear you guys.
I love the reunion, Grace.
Well, the CDC issued new guidance this week on booster shots. But before we get into which shot to get and when, let's touch a little bit on the Bay Area, where the Bay Area is right now with COVID rates. Are we finally out of the woods, Aaron Alday?
Well, I don't know that we can say out of the woods quite. We're in another one of those now familiar lulls, right, where we're coming down from a surge. We seem to be plateauing a little bit, and we're plateauing at a kind of higher level than we're used to in these lulls between surges. But, you know, we're in a really good place. We never really kind of got a terrible situation in this Delta surge like a lot of other parts of the country. And I think the big question on everybody's mind now is just what's going to happen this winter. And there's a lot of factors to keep your eyes on. And it's probably a whole other conversation there. But you know, right now things are looking pretty good. You know, I think we're all kind of getting used to what the sort of level of transmission feels like and sort of evaluating what, you know, we feel we can and want to do and need to do in these times.
And Aaron Alday, San Francisco Chronicle, we should mention that's your affiliation. So what are the vaccination rates right now in the Bay Area and beyond?
They're really great for the most part. So we have, I actually just looked at it today, and in the nine counties, you know, anywhere between a low of just under 60%, I think about 50%, 58% of the total population vaccinated in Solano County, and up to around 80% in like Marin County of people of the entire population. That's including those who aren't even eligible for vaccinations. They're already at 80% vaccinated, which is just incredible. And around the Bay Area, it's, you know, usually in that kind of 70 to 75% range, which is just, if you think about the fact that we have, you know, huge groups of these young people, you know, children under age 12 who aren't even eligible for vaccination yet, those are really spectacular numbers for vaccination rates.
And what do you attribute the high rates here in the Bay Area to?
You know, I think all along the folks here have just been very kind of pro-science, pro, you know, listening to kind of their health officials, listening to their local leaders, kind of prepared to do what it takes to keep this thing under control. You know, and as much as we talk about how difficult and challenging the politicization of this pandemic has made things in the United States, I think in some ways in the Bay Area, it's worked out in our favor. I guess you could argue it depends on where your politics lie, but you know, because it's become so politicized, it's almost become, you know, a mark to of where you stand to get vaccinated, right? To be very positive about vaccination and to mask up and all those things. And so, you know, we do see an unusually high uptake of all of these prevention measures that, you know, have been questioned in other parts of the country.
Well, Peter Chin Hong, you're a doctor, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. And I want to ask you, are we any closer to getting vaccines for school-aged children?
Yes. In fact, the meeting is tomorrow for the Pfizer vaccine. And we've not only seen data so far with antibody response, but most recently, Pfizer submitted disease outcome data showing that the vaccine in kids aged 5 to 11 was more than 90% effective in preventing symptomatic infection disease. So I think all roads are leading to FDA approval from their scientific advisory board. And we know the drill. After that, goes to the CDC. And then Dr. Rochelle Walensky then ratifies that decision. So we're looking at early November for the latest estimates for when they can actually go into arms. So it'll be an early Thanksgiving present and right in time, I think, for travel for the holidays.
And Peter, a lot of people are starting to think about their third shot as those approvals have been made by the federal regulators. So what do you recommend people do about getting their third shot? Who's eligible at this point?
So who's eligible isn't necessarily the people who should run out and get it. So those who are eligible are those who are older than 65 and those who are over 18 who have some medical comorbidity or whose occupation puts them at risk for ongoing exposure. So in terms of the hierarchy, you know, I think of it like a traffic light, red, amber, and green. The red group is definitely those who are immunocompromised or those who are older than 65. I think data suggests that the vaccine efficacy, particularly for Pfizer, is not only resulting in lower antibodies, but it's resulting in uptick in hospitalizations a little bit in that age group from about, I'd say, 91% 2 weeks after the vaccine to 4 weeks after the vaccine. And this is U.S. data, to about 77%. So I'd say for that group, which is most pronounced in over 75, actually, if you look at the data, I'd, you know, go out and get that. And immunocompromised folks, we're just trying to get them up to the level of the general population by additional shots. In terms of amber, that's the group who else is included, including those who are younger than 65, whether by work or where they live. I would say that the data in the U.S. isn't compelling in terms of saying that the vaccines are resulting in people in that group going to the hospital in large droves. I think it's a good idea at some point. I think it would be a morale booster, particularly if you're a healthcare worker and you want to be feeling confident as the winter approaches to think about it. But again, no disease urgency imperative to rush out right now and get it. And then there's the green group, which is everybody else. And again, whether or not those who don't fall in that those groups will get the green light to go and get the booster remains to be seen.
Well, Peter, should we expect that we'll have to get boosters every year and that for COVID, and this is going to be our new normal, like a COVID booster shot is going to be like getting a flu shot?
That's a great question, Grace. So I think about whether or not we're going to be stuck with Delta being the worst thing that we're going to see. And it may not be the case. So if it gets as only as bad as Delta, then I think if and remains stable, we think that the third shot would actually boost you out for many years after. In other words, many vaccines are given in threes, if you think about it, like MMR and hepatitis B and even human papillomavirus. And the reason for that strategy is that you kind of hit hard with the priming in the first month with a couple shots, and then you remind the immune system like maybe a few months later, and that's the boost. And it turns out that if the infection remains stable, the enemy, you can protect yourself for many years. Of course, COVID is a shapeshifter of a virus, SARS-CoV-2. So if there's some weird new descendant of Delta or some new variant that's as bad as Delta, that looks very different to the immune system, we may need a booster sooner rather than later. But I'm holding out for the long haul and hoping that this booster for most people will end up taking us many years across the finish line.
Well, Aaron, there's now talk of a new drug that will actually treat COVID. And is there any concern that the new COVID treatment drug might make people reluctant to get vaccinated? I mean, if there's a cure, why get a vaccination? Is that something that people have been hearing?
You know, I don't think so. The folks who aren't getting vaccinated, it's such a kind of nuanced, it's a hard thing to kind of dive into, like the reasons why people aren't, and they're multifaceted. And you know, certainly we can't really be making decisions like that. Do we, you know, go forward with a treatment for COVID, you know, yes or no, based on is it going to harm vaccination efforts? So, you know, even if there was an issue, I don't know if there's anything that we could or would do about it. But no, I haven't really been hearing that. And, you know, I think it's worth though explaining here that, you know, we need a treatment for a whole lot of reasons. And one is, frankly, to help treat those who may choose not to be vaccinated. But it's also for, you know, the older folks who maybe didn't get a booster, and it's a rare occurrence, but it does happen that people end up in the hospital and they end up with serious COVID. If we had something that would, you know, we could give folks, say, in nursing home situations early on, as soon as they have symptoms, that could prevent, you know, on top of the vaccination, could prevent severe illness, that would be, I mean, people said it'd be game changing. Same in a lot of scenarios, to be able to have kind of these multifaceted, you know, options for preventing severe illness is exactly what we need and what we're looking for. And so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't negate the vaccines. It doesn't really mean anything in combination with the vaccines, except to say that, you know, it's just one, you know, one layer on top of another. It's the way we kind of should be looking at these types of treatments.
And Aaron, in terms of this vaccine hesitancy that you're sort of alluding to in responding to Grace's question, I'm wondering if where you think we're heading with all of this. It seems like at this point, we've kind of done all the incentives that we can, and now we're seeing a lot of companies and governments, school districts, et cetera, mandating vaccinations. Do you think this is going to get us to that point of herd immunity, or whatever threshold we would need to get to the point where we're really in a safe place and we don't have the same risks that we do with a relatively large unvaccinated population?
So I'll be curious to hear what Peter might have to say about this, but the impression I get is that we're not getting to herd immunity. That's just not really on the table anymore. This is between Delta and just how infectious it is, and what we know about, you know, I don't want to necessarily factor waning immunity in there because we don't know enough about waning immunity, but we also don't know how durable these vaccines are and how they play out over a long period of time. But, you know, it's just possible that with Delta, it's just going to be impossible to reach the level of kind of global herd immunity that we would need to really stomp this out. So even if, say, the Bay Area or San Francisco gets to, say, 90%, which is, you know, potentially what it would take to knock back Delta, we're still going to be, you know, at the mercy of our neighbors, of even just our neighbors in California and other counties. And it's just not going to be possible to get to high enough levels that we can just stamp it out to the point where we can forget about it. So it's going to be endemic. It's going to be something that we're dealing with. That being said, I mean, that sounds sort of depressing because, I mean, maybe we've been thinking about herd immunity as an option, but it's really not. I mean, we have already such high vaccination uptake. And once we get these kids on board, we're going to have high enough levels of immunity in the Bay Area that it may be that it's just not much of a bother for us, right? Like, we can just, if we see cases kind of starting to climb, maybe we start masking up. You know, there might be some sort of long-term mask usage and some other things that come into play. But I think for the most part, you know, when you get to really high levels of vaccination, you kind of just say, well, you know, we live with the flu, we live with other respiratory illnesses, and we go about our lives, and you know, we're actually in pretty good shape. Our hospitals are fine. We're not seeing really, you know, horrible levels of disease, and we reach a point where we can kind of live with this. And I think in the Bay Area, we're basically at there or very close to that point.
And Peter, anything to add to that, and any just closing kind of messages you'd want to convey as we wrap up this section of the,
yeah,
of the show?
Definitely. First, in response to your comment of carrot or stick, I've been really shocked to see how much the stick has been working recently. I was really impressed by the LA Unified School District data, for example, where in late September, I think 80% vaccination rate in teachers and staff for schools. And then they had the mandate deadline last Monday. And then all of a sudden, 97% vaccination overall and 99% in teachers. So, you know, this might be California and may not be generalizable, because at the same hand, you have the police union in New York striking. But it does really speak to the power of mandates. In terms of Aaron's sort of realistic comments about not reaching herd immunity, I agree. And I think it's really about disease control. And I think we'll have multiple tools in our toolkit, the most powerful being vaccines, but there'll also be the oral agents. And I think monoclonal antibodies as an option for people who can't have an immune response, like particularly an immunocompromised, is an exciting new option with these long-acting monoclonal antibodies being developed now.
Well, it's so great to get an update from the both of you on COVID. Thanks so much for joining us. Peter Ching Hong, he's the infectious disease specialist with UCSF, and Erin Alday, she's a health reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks, Erin and Peter.
Thanks so much,
you guys.
Thanks. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll be talking about the rise in eating disorders among Bay Area teens with Dr. Ariel Trost and Katie Bell.
So do you have any questions or comments for our guests about eating disorders or the influence social media might have on how we eat or don't eat? We want you to be a part of this conversation, so give us a call with questions or comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay. evening and welcome back to State of the Bay. Tonight, we're going to talk about a closer look at eating disorders. And tomorrow, executives from YouTube, TikTok, and Snapchat are scheduled to testify before a Senate subcommittee about the effects of their social media platforms on children. They're expected to face questions about how they manage content that encourages eating disorders and how their algorithms might actually promote that content to young people.
Indeed, eating disorders among teens, as well as other age groups, have been rising sharply during the pandemic. We have two experts with us tonight to help us sort out the reasons why, the role of social media, and most importantly, what families can do to prevent and address eating disorders in teens.
So with us here tonight is Dr. Ariel Trost. Ariel is a clinical psychologist in Oakland and co-founder of Connect ED, a community of Bay Area eating disorder specialists dedicated to outreach and education. Welcome, Dr. Trost.
Thanks. So happy to be here.
We also have here in the studio tonight Katie Bell. Katie's a board-certified medical and psychiatric nurse practitioner and co-founder of the Healthy Teen Project, a Bay Area eating disorder treatment program. Welcome to State of the Bay, Katie Bell.
Thank you very much. Thanks for this opportunity.
Oh, pleasure. Why are we seeing such a steep rise in teen mental health issues, particularly eating disorders, during this pandemic? Well, let's start with you, Dr. Trost.
So I'm glad that you asked. I see there being sort of three pathways to eating disorders, and we're seeing a rise in all of them right now during the pandemic. So I would sort of start with this idea of during a time of great uncertainty, we all look for ways to both soothe ourselves and to create some sense of order. And so focusing on food, focusing on exercise goals, those can be one pathway to that. Another pathway, of course, is body image. And so spending more time on screens, spending more time isolated from peers in your room with mirrors, that kind of focus can also lead to a rise in certain types of behaviors around restriction or trying to manage food that can lead to real unhealthy consequences.
And Dr. Trost, can you help us untangle the relationship between anxiety and depression and eating disorders? And can you speak specifically about the impact of social and academic pressures and the self-soothing aspect of eating disorders?
Yeah, I think that's it's complicated. So when it comes to anxiety and eating disorders, what I see is that sometimes, so I have one client who I'm thinking of specifically who, when I started working with her, she was in college during the pandemic and had transitioned beautifully to school, was less anxious than she had ever been before. Turns out she was in the midst of a really acute eating disorder, and the starvation was actually sort of helping her to physiologically calm herself. So what had, you know, somebody who had had a pretty raging anxiety disorder before the pandemic, as she was starting to manage her food more, as she was walking more, as she was sort of in this negative energy balance, all of her physiology calmed and her anxiety was actually managed by this eating disorder. Once she was refed and back to medical health, the anxiety really raged. So that's one direction, but sometimes the other piece of that, sort of ironically, is that a malnourished brain is also an anxious brain. So the very thing that you're doing to sort of manage your anxiety can actually make you sort of more anxious or more depressed. So it's always tricky to sort of tease these things apart. We always treat the eating disorder first because that is the most medically acute and sort of the most the highest priority in terms of stabilizing the teen or young adult. And so we treat that first, and then we sort of see what's happening underneath that.
Mm-hmm. Well, Katie Bell, I wanted to bring you in here. Dr. Trost has been talking about, you know, some of the signatures of having an eating disorder. There's, I know about dramatic weight changes, but what else might you see associated with eating disorders, the physical effects of it?
Oh, yeah. Some of the things you would see, obviously, is weight loss. You would actually see some the individual become more isolated. You would see them pull away from their family and from their friends. You would see, for females, loss of a menstrual period. You would see some of the physical changes, such as potentially headaches, complaints of headaches. One of the key symptoms that present in the pediatrics office would be abdominal pain, a complaint of vague abdominal pain. Generally, what you'll hear parents, families, and friends report is the individual becomes more isolated and moves away from their friends and families, and you will see changes in their eating behaviors and start to present with physical complaints, vague physical complaints, such as vague abdominal pain or headaches.
Hmm. And Katie, who tends to be most susceptible to having an eating disorder? Is it girls or boys, teens or young adults, athletes? Is there a particular socioeconomic group that seems to be most vulnerable?
There's no socioeconomic group or that is more prone to eating disorders. We see them across all individuals, all ages, and all cultures, actually. There's psychological factors, there's sociocultural factors, and there's biological factors. So we would see for psychological factors, you would potentially see somebody who is perfectionistic, is rigid, people pleaser. For sociocultural factors, you might see an individual who is engaged or pulled into the culture's focus on body image and the desire to be thin, and some of the biological factors that you would see associated with eating disorders are individuals who suffer from anxiety or depression. And also family histories of eating disorders.
Can I jump in with just something that I think is always surprising to people? The two groups that have the fastest growing rates of eating disorders right now are boys and young children. So kids between the ages of 9 and 11, that group is really growing pretty quickly in terms of eating disorder presentation. And boys. So it's a fantastic question and so important because oftentimes parents just assume that their boys will be fine.
Yeah. Well, and often I've heard the term used disordered eating. I think people think about an eating disorder and maybe they're thinking of one thing, but disordered eating is something that a term that I've heard used. And is that something that you would think about when you're talking about eating disorders with kids, Dr. Trost?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that the research shows that subclinical eating disorders, so eating disorders that don't actually meet all of the criteria that's in, you know, the big sort of diagnostic Bible, that those have the same kinds of medical complications as more acute eating disorders. So, I think that this idea that dieting or, you know, sort of some of the wellness culture behaviors around cleansing or skipping meals or things like that, that those are sort of innocuous or normal teen behaviors, I think that's a really problematic belief.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan, along with my co-host Ethan Elkind. We're talking with Dr. Ariel Trost and Katie Bell about eating disorders. Do you have a question for our guests? You can join our program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at stateofbay. Katie, we mentioned in our introduction the Senate subcommittee meeting tomorrow when executives from YouTube, TikTok, and Snapchat, they're going to testify about the influence of their platforms on teen mental health, including eating disorders. Can you talk about the impact of social media and how COVID may have exacerbated that and the unexpected consequences of having so much time on Zoom, which I have come to dread myself?
Well, Ed Ariel, Dr. Trost spoke about this earlier, but with the social isolation, you know, it wasn't just fear of missing out. The teens were really, truly missing out. And that's when we saw increased anxiety and depression. And in mental health, adolescent mental health, this has been referred to as the second pandemic. And so with regards to the social media, some of the stories that I'm hearing teens share with me is a couple of things. One, that they're following social media fitness influencers. It's not uncommon to hear them reference individuals that are doing fitness workouts. And so to marry this to sort of their experience day to day is during COVID, they were in lockdowns, and I heard one I've heard many teens share something similar. But one teen in particular share about how she was aware during the lockdowns that her peers were actually working out. And so when the spring came around this last year, she started to become quite stressed about returning to school this fall. Mm. And actually, she had gained a little bit of weight during COVID, which is appropriate for a teen to gain weight during adolescence. So she had gained a little bit of weight, and she became so fearful that in comparison to her peers when she came back this fall, and she lost about a third of her body weight in about 4 to 5 months. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, Katie, you mentioned these social media influencers as maybe contributing to some of the problem here if they're heavily engaged in fitness activities that are leading to some unhealthy behavior. But I'd be interested more on that, but also just if there are teens that generally tend to get more triggered by what they see on social media than others. Are there certain types that are more susceptible to social media influence and pressures?
These are individuals. These teens are the individuals that buy into the thin culture ideal. And so these teens might be more susceptible to seeing images on social media that they want to emulate and look like. I can't tell you how many teens that I've seen and talked to that speak to that I want to look like this. I'll never look like this. And it continues to reinforce not good enough.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was so interesting, though, about in the Facebook whistleblower's testimony was about the algorithms around healthy eating. Mm. And so even teens who are not necessarily, trying to look like a particular influencer, if they are seeking out healthy recipes or good mm-hmm. workouts, these algorithms are feeding them into pro-anorexia types of mm-hmm. of information. And so, even if they're not seeking it out, mm-hmm. it's coming for them.
Yeah.
Well, it's totally frightening as a mother of teens myself, I have to say. And I mean, when we talk about those algorithms, I mean, let's expand a little bit on that, Dr. Trost. Is it that the algorithms, the kids aren't looking for it, but the social media companies are saying, here's more, here's more, and here's more?
I think so. I mean, I think it also speaks to the fact that, when I present to parents, I talk about how many parents of our generation, we know that diets don't work. We're not pushing diets, but we have kind of traded diet culture for like wellness culture. Mm-hmm. And so there's this idea that being keto or Whole30 or, gluten-free or, these cleanses or detoxes, like that's kind of still fair game. And so I think that, that can really, if you're a teen, if you have concrete thinking about right or wrong or good or bad, and you've got a kid who's perfectionistic or a pleaser and can really do it well, that can lead to pretty extreme behaviors. And these algorithms are clearly sort of encouraging that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Janice calling in from San Jose. So, Janice, welcome to State of the Bay.
Oh, thank you so much, both of you. I'm just calling to thank Dr. Trost and Katie so much for their Healthy Teen program. They have helped so many teens in our community, and we just we are blessed to have them in our community. And just to let your listeners know that there are resources. The Eating Disorder Resource Center is out there, 356-1212. That's 408, and we can help families that are dealing with this. And we like to help families so that the healthy teen can work on helping the client, and so we can be there to support the families, because it's just as hard of an illness on the families mm-hmm. as it is on the person struggling.
Well, thank you, Janice, for calling in with that vote of confidence for the work of our guest tonight. And Ariel, wanted to ask you a bit, since you mentioned your clinic, if you could just describe a bit about how your clinic works.
As much as I would love to take credit for the Healthy Teen program, it is Katie Bell's clinic, and so I'm going to let her speak to it. But it's a place that I refer to often, and it is without parallel. And we're so fortunate in our community because there's a San Francisco office and a Los Altos office, and it is where teens need to go if they're real sick.
Thank you, Ariel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Healthy Teen Project was founded in 2013. It was founded because there wasn't a dedicated program for teens with adult teens and families with adolescents in the Bay Area. And it became apparent to us that families were looking for that kind of program for support not only for their teen but their family as well. And so we are both now in Los Altos and opened up our second clinic in December of 2019.
On the one hand, it's great that the resources and you have a second clinic. On the other hand, it's just so sad that, you know, that the need is so there for people. But I wanted to go back to social media because I think it's something that parents think a lot about after 2 years of online school with the kids. It's not as simple as blaming social media, I guess. No. And can you tell us, Ariel, some other factors that are leading to these eating disorders? I mean, it's not a new phenomenon, but obviously it's increased a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I mentioned, I think that the rise in anxiety and really the rise in this sort of health consciousness, and I'm putting it in air quotes, you know, I think that there is so much weight stigma and fat phobia in our community, and that leads people to restrict. And there's so much anxiety in our community that leads people to develop stomach symptoms that make them not hungry and make them skip meals because they're studying, or, you know, make them eat meals on the go and all of that kind of stuff. And so I'm glad that you brought it up because I think that social media contributes, but I don't think it's the cause. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that parents who are really well-intentioned can sort of feed into with their kids that, you know, they don't mean to, but they are sort of walking their kid down a pretty scary road.
Like you're just on a keto plan just to lose a couple of pounds. And is that a bad thing? I mean, if I'm a person who decides to eat a certain way, is that bad modeling for my child?
So I would say, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, as a therapist, I'm not going to call it bad modeling. I'm going to suggest that maybe what you could do instead is focus on behaviors rather than your weight, right? Mm-hmm. So if what you're noticing is during the pandemic, you know, you are eating in front of screens too much and you weren't getting outside of the house to move your body, focusing on that is great modeling for our kids. Focusing on these extreme, and I'm glad you brought up keto because it's another one, focusing on these extreme eating behaviors in the name of health is not healthy for our kids. And so, you know, a lot of families did this during the pandemic. There were the families baking bread, and then there were the families who were going entirely plant-based, vegan, and sort of taking that on as a challenge, which on the face of it sounds kind of fun. But when you are a growing child who needs all of the nutrition and who is told that eating a certain way is good or bad, that can really lead to all kinds of the problems that Katie and I see.
Yeah.
And Katie, talking about social media, but other factors as well, are there certain warning signs that parents or guardians should be looking out for at home to identify or even try to preempt an eating disorder?
So just in a nutshell, when food, weight, appearance, and or exercise become a top priority for a teen above all else in a way that's affecting their quality of life, concern is definitely warranted. So to just piggyback on what Dr. Trost was just speaking to, the key here that I would recommend for parents and families and friends is to create lifestyle changes that foster a relaxed, and I think that's the key, a relaxed relationship with food.
And joyful.
And joyful, free from binging, restricting, and emotional eating. I think if there's any message to take away, model a balanced relationship with food, weight, and exercise is what we see as the greatest prevention for teens in developing disordered eating or eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think as a parent, again, I mean, I see what we do, but I also see that my kids look a lot to what their friends' families do and what their friends are doing. I mean, how much influence do I have as a parent versus my kids' peer group?
And the most.
The most. And that's, Dr. Trost, you think it's the most.
It is. I mean, the research shows us over and over again. So if our, you know, if we are sitting down and eating meals and, you know, it doesn't have to be every night for dinner, but if we are you know, I mean, in my house, like the rule, like you never skip a meal, like that there's a rule. It's the same as like, yeah. you know, not wearing a seatbelt. Like we need three meals a day and you never are eating, you know, in your bedroom, you know, out of the box of crackers. You're sitting down at the table eating off of a plate. So, you know, changing this mindset of restriction to just one of structure and sort of, you know, teaching that from as young an age as you can and continuing it on up.
Well, what happens if you start noticing behavior patterns like restrictive eating or binge eating or something even more mild, like just a change in how a person is eating? If you see it in your child or a friend, what's the best way to broach that? And I'll start with you, Katie, but I'd like to hear from you both.
Yeah. The first step I would do is to educate yourself. So there's a wonderful resource. It's called the National Eating Disorder Awareness Association, NEDA. It's easy to find online if you were just to type in NEDA and eating disorder. They have a parent toolkit there. It's approximately 74 pages, and it walks through what are the warning signs. One of the kind of key takeaways I think that our colleagues wanted us to be sure to communicate today was that individuals at any weight can have an eating disorder. And individuals at a higher weight relative to their height can lose a lot of weight, and that can be totally missed that they're developing an eating disorder. So that's, you know, so that's a very, very important thing. Oftentimes individuals in larger bodies relative to their height or stature will lose weight, and they're congratulated by their peers and their families. So it's something to be thinking about. But educate yourself, and then usually parents have a spidey sense around this. That's what I like to call it. If they have a sense that something's up, the next thing, and this piggybacks on what Arielle, Dr. Trost was speaking to, is knowing what your kid's eating, just observing. It doesn't necessarily mean to have to helicopter, but pay attention to what your child's eating. It's important for them to develop independence and autonomy with their food as a teenager appropriately. But at the same time, make sure that they're getting the three meals and snack, depending on what their activity level is, and make sure that they're not skipping meals. And then if you do see that something is up, then create a quiet space, take some time to sit down with your child and explore more what's going on. And usually what you would anticipate is if there is something going on, that they're probably going to be a little defensive about it. And that is in itself a red flag. And then if you there's a red flag there, then I would encourage you to schedule an appointment with your pediatric provider. It's important to see if they have some experience working with eating disorders. And then I would also rein in an eating disorder specialist, a registered dietitian or a therapist to start to consult with and formally assess.
Good advice, Dr. Trost. Anything to add?
Awesome advice. I think that the only thing I would add to that is that before taking your kid into the pediatrician, I think it's great if it's possible to reach out to your pediatrician beforehand in advance of that appointment and sort of give them a sense of what you're seeing and what your concerns are. I'm always encouraging parents to ask about the growth curve. So oftentimes parents don't understand or don't know, haven't been educated that what we want is for our kid to stay on their growth curve. So as Katie mentioned earlier, a kid who's always been in a bigger body now is at more of an average weight, that kid can be struggling with an eating disorder that a doctor might not notice unless they're really comparing their weight to their growth curve. So talking with the doctor in advance is important.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is State of the Bay on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind along with my co-host Grace Wan. We're talking with Dr. Arielle Trost and Katie Bell about eating disorders. And if you have questions for our guests, we would love to hear from you. You can join the program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. And Katie, let me go to you with a question, picking up from where we were just leaving off in terms of if you notice really alarming behavior. And if it gets to the point where a medical professional determines that a person has an eating disorder and let's say could be a life or death situation, right? So is time of the essence? And can you just talk us through the next steps and where the Healthy Teen Project might come in.
Yeah, we encourage parents and families and friends that if they are concerned that there's an eating disorder, to seek care right away. And part of that is it's all due to the fact that from the research, what has been shown and demonstrated is that the earlier that an eating disorder is successfully treated, the more likely the prognosis is very, very good. So as Arielle was speaking earlier, as a teen or young adult becomes more entrenched in their thinking, the malnourished brain makes it much more difficult for them to actually have good insight and judgment about what's going on, and it becomes more difficult to actually effectively treat the eating disorder. So the sooner you can identify it through the process of getting experienced and seasoned assessments, the better that will be for the teen. And it's not easy. The treatment involves what's referred to as the four-pronged approach. It requires both a medical provider, often your pediatrician, an eating disorder therapist and registered dietitian, as well as a psychiatric provider. So those are four different disciplines that are typically involved and required to effectively treat an eating disorder successfully. But if the parents are and family and friends are able to find that support and care immediately, we see the prognosis is very good.
Well, we have a listener question. A listener asks, your guests are talking a lot about food restriction, but what about exercise? My son's cohort seems obsessed with getting more muscular, drinking protein shakes, etc. Is that something to be looking out for? Dr. Trost?
Absolutely. I think that any type of behavior that becomes compulsive, and so the way that I would define compulsive is sort of interfering with other types of functioning. So, you know, what I think about when parents are asking about how much exercise is healthy exercise, it's like, is this child engaging in exercise at weird times of the day or from a place of obligation or guilt because of, you know, or desire to change their body, or are they engaging in exercise because it's social and fun and it's given them endorphins and they're feeling great from it. So, you know, I think some amount of body pride and focus can be normal among a teenage cohort. But again, I'm sort of watching for, are there other things that are getting sort of pushed aside because of this focus? Or, you know, is the mood impacted if they're not able to get to the gym with their buddies or if they don't like what they see in the mirror? So, you know, I mean, honestly, I talk about it with my kids because working out can be really joyful and really social and really connected, and we also see how it can go to the dark side.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we have another listener who asks, how much does the relationship between the teen and their parents influence an eating disorder? And maybe, Katie, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, that can be a pretty significant influence on the development of an eating disorder, and that's not in any way or shape or form to blame parents. It's just teens obviously are going through that developmental period, and they're trying to establish independence from their parents and starting to look more towards their peers for support, influence, and autonomy. But the relationship with the parents can be conflicted and make it challenging for create stressors and potentially unnecessary stressors in a teen's life that is then expressed in different ways. And so from an eating disorder standpoint, what we might hear a teen report, or often we hear a teen report, is they're looking to maintain control in their life. And so if something is happening in a relationship with their family, with their parents, that is making them feel like they don't have control, it's not uncommon to hear the teen report that I just needed to control my diet and my health. This was one manner of gaining control.
Katie alluded to this, but I'd really want to underscore it. I see some of the happiest, best, highest functioning families in my office. So, I mean, I see all kinds of families, and, you know, at its core, families don't cause eating disorders, and families, you know, in Katie's program really help
their kids dig out of eating disorders. Yeah. So, you know, just to make sure that we're clear, because so oftentimes parents are, you know, feel terribly guilty because of that keto thing that they did, right, or because of, you know, letting their kid be on social media too much, or because of, you know, not paying enough attention or whatever. And, you know, parents will always find a reason that it was their fault, and kids will always find a reason why it was their parents' fault too.
The age old cycle. Well, with the 2 minutes we have left, I want to just let our listeners know about resources and where they can reach out to get some help. So I'll start with you, Dr. Trost, and then you, Katie. Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners where they can go to get help.
Oh, it's a good question. I don't know if you guys have show notes, but if you do, we can certainly provide you with some resources. Katie mentioned NEDA, so the National Eating Disorder Association. That is a great place. A few of my brilliant colleagues and I started connectedbayarea.com. And so if you go to that website, you can email me directly and ask me for local resources.
The caller, the one of the first callers that called in, Janice Bremis from the Eating Disorder Recovery Center in Silicon Valley, she's got a treatment directory. This was founded about 15 years ago, and there's a treatment directory there for all disciplines. That four-pronged approach, it includes therapists, registered dietitians, medical providers, and psychiatric providers. So those are, that would be a great resource to go to, and they have a support phone line and a support line. They have support groups. So that's an incredible Bay Area resource.
And one thing that I'm hearing from families is that all of us practitioners are full, and so families are calling, you know, 20, 30 of us, and everybody's full. What I suggest to families is to even just ask for a one-hour consultation, and you can get so much direction and information and resources. So, you know, again, reaching out to Connected Bay Area, or, you know, if your pediatrician recommends somebody, if that person is full, you know, just asking, can I get an hour of your time?
Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned there, too, it's not uncommon actually for parents to call the Healthy Teen Project directly and been available to them as just a consult, a 10 to 15 minute phone conversation. Other providers in the community do also call in and consult with us as well, just what we would refer to as a curbside consult, and we're always available to help and support people.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we'll make sure that we'll put some of these resources on our webpage. You can go to kalw.org to get some of those. And I want to just thank our guests for joining us, Katie Bell, nurse practitioner, co-founder of the Healthy Teen Project, and Dr. Ariel Trost, clinical psychologist and co-founder of Connected. Thank you both so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much for having us.
And next up, we have Ethan's interview with Dan Zielinski of San Francisco's own Musée Mécanique. Stay tuned.
Musée Mécanique has been a San Francisco institution for more than 50 decades now. Originally housed at the Cliff House, it is now located at Fisherman's Wharf, where visitors can see the world's largest privately owned collection of antique arcade machines and mechanically operated musical instruments. Started by Ed Zielinski, it's now run by his son, Dan Zielinski, who can be seen roller skating around his museum, tinkering with the machines most days. Welcome to State of the Bay, Dan.
Well, thank you.
So, Dan, is it really true that you prefer roller skating to walking?
No question about it. I have incorporated so many tasks that I need the skates to get around quicker to accomplish all of them. And not to mention, it's an awful lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it's definitely adds to the flavor. And let me just start from the beginning here. What's the story of Musée Mécanique?
Well, my dad was playing bingo at his school when he was 11 years old. And he won the bingo tournament, and that gave him the opportunity to go on the school stage in the auditorium. They had a Wheel of Fortune set up, and he gave it a spin, and it landed on the grand prize. He was very excited, what 11-year-old wouldn't be. And it turned out the grand prize was a case of oil for a car, which he couldn't have cared less about. So he took the oil home and sold it to his piano teacher for 50 cents. And not far from where he used to live, there was a store that sold penny arcade machines. And he found one for 50 cents, and he bought it. He took it home. His mom and dad put pennies in it, and his friends put pennies in it. And he soon had another 50 cents and went out and bought another one. And that's how this entire show started.
Wow. Well, so what was it like for you growing up with a dad who was so into these collectibles, which is pretty unusual?
It was second nature. He had a whole collection at home before I was born, so I was just born into it. And so I just thought it was normal, just common. I have to admit, we had some pretty great birthday parties.
And Dan, how did your dad come to start it as a museum?
My dad acquired a piano, an upright player piano, and was going to move it into the house, but he had to get rid of the couch to do that. And my mom said, "You're not doing that. Get an arcade." So that was incentive to get an arcade. Too many machines at home. And we had slot machines in the bathroom. They were in the hallway. They were in every nook and cranny. They were everywhere. My dad was a lot of fun.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And I know most people in San Francisco, well, long-timers may remember that the museum's home was just below the Cliff House, originally among the crashing waves of the ocean there. But that wasn't the first home, was it?
No, my dad's first location was in Tiburon. There used to be a restaurant there called The Dock. And he had a beautiful arcade under there. And there was a fire in the mid-late 60s, and so we moved everything out of there and into the Cliff House.
And Dan, let's talk about some of the items and collectibles that people will find when they come into the Musée Mécanique. So when you first enter, there's a huge 6-foot-tall, freckled, gap-toothed mechanical woman laughing at nobody in particular. So what's the story with creepy laughing Sal?
Well, you nailed that one. She is creepy, and she's been terrifying kids or making us laugh for decades, I think since the 20s. She used to be at Playland and would laugh every day of the year for 15 hours a day. The Philadelphia Toboggan Company manufactured Laughing Sal, among other things, but we'll talk about Laughing Sal. And as far as I know, they made over 500 of them, and they would, you know, build them as quickly as they got orders for them, and they would ship them all over the country until World War II started, and that was the end of the production of Laughing Sal. I have one from Playland, and there's another one from Playland that is now at the Santa Cruz Boardwalk. As far as I know, the Playland had two Laughing Sals, so if one was broken, they'd just swap them out because she had to be there every day laughing.
And I know there are over 300 mechanical machines in your Musée Mécanique. So can you tell us about the band organ? Can you just describe a bit about what it does and a little bit about its background?
Yes. The band organ that we have here was built in 1915. It was first installed in a carousel in Tennessee in 1917. Anyway, it came up for auction in Las Vegas. And I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to afford this. And they said it was in perfect working condition. So I went down there to check it out, and it was absolutely gorgeous. It was flawless, inside and out. It was perfect. And it's the same type of machine that you'll hear when you ride a merry-go-round in an amusement park. It just blasts music throughout the entire park. It pretty much does that here at the Musée Mécanique. And it puts a smile on everybody's face.
Well, let's give it a listen and see what it sounds like. So, Dan, can you tell me a bit about the crybaby machine?
Absolutely, I'd love to. I have a mechanical automata of a dad standing up, holding his baby in his arms. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and he's feeding his baby. And if you put a coin in, he moves back and forth, and you can hear the baby crying. Well, when my son was 2 months old, 1 o'clock in the morning, my wife said, it's your turn to go feed him. So I was just about to give him a bottle, and I thought I could really use a new recording for my crybaby machine. So instead of giving him a bottle, I gave him a microphone. And yes, he did cry and cry and cry and cry. So when you play this machine, it is definitely Connor crying, wondering why he's not being fed.
So, Dan, can you tell me about the roulette slot machine and how that came to be in the collection?
My dad was always trading and looking for new machines to add to his collection. And one day he came across a roulette table, coin-operated with nickels. And, I mean, it's a devastatingly gorgeous piece to this day. It's one of the feathers in the cap for any collector of coin-operated machines. And my dad had a friend that wanted to buy it from him. And my dad said, well, it's not for sale. And my dad's friend offered him twice what it was worth. And he says, no, it's really not for sale. The guy came back several times over the course of a year and offered him triple what it was worth, quadruple what it was worth. My dad just said, no, I really like this machine. So the guy comes back a year later and he says, Ed, this is my final offer. I have a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house in Mill Valley. I'll trade you. And my dad said, okay. And so I think my dad made out. My dad always did well in trading every time. But that was a humdinger, I have to admit. That was a good one.
Wow, it's quite a trade. I don't think a trade like that has ever probably been done before or since. So let's talk about the collection of Peep Show machines that you have there. Can you just tell us a bit about what they're like and what was considered sexy back then in the early teens?
Well, they're definitely non-scandalous by today's standards. But back in the early teens, the girly pictures that are in my 3D stereo optic machines were very risque for the time. And risque by those standards, where you could see an ankle on a young lady, or they had a short sleeve blouse, or you know, something like that.
Well, and Dan, anything else that you want to mention about the Musée Mécanique?
We're open every day of the year, and it's free admission every day of the year. So if it's free admission, they basically don't care what it is. They're coming in no matter what, and then they find a lot of great surprises in here.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dan. And for those of you who would like to visit the Musée Mécanique with all of its vintage penny arcade games and musical contraptions, just make your way down to Fisherman's Wharf at the end of Taylor Street in San Francisco. Admission is free, and don't forget to bring your quarters.
That was Dan Zielinski of San Francisco's Musée Mécanique. For a link to the Musée Mécanique website, visit the State of the Bay page at kalw.org.
And that's State of the Bay this week. I want to thank our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday, our co-host Joseph Pache will sit down with Jose Vadi. He's the author of Interstate, Essays from California.
If you have a question for any of next week's guests, you can email us at stateofbay@gmail.com or send us a tweet at stateofbay.
For a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper, Jennifer Ruick, and Jillian Emblad.
I'm Grace Swan with co-host Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a great week.